The short story, The Pitch. It was November, and Detroit was even grayer than normal. But what is normal in Detroit? Some would say 600 murders a year. As we drove down the John Lodge Expressway towards Detroit's inner city, I kept asking myself what I was doing. Maggie and I had been living in safe suburban Farmington since returning to Detroit, my hometown. I'd returned to head up an advertising creative team specializing in the marketing of automobiles. I'd left the world of advertising 3 years before to pursue my first love, comedy. A brief fling as a contributing writer for Saturday Night Live in its first year, and several unsuccessful TV pilots later led me back to advertising. But not just advertising, automobile advertising. Some would say the most uncreative of all. But if you're going to be doing auto ads, there's only one place to do it. Then that's Detroit. Besides that, it paid the bills, and I had plenty of them. An ex-wife and two kids in Kalamazoo received the majority of what I could earn, and what was left was mine. It was a major reason why I had moved back to Detroit after reluctantly admitting show business was no business for me. We had an 11 a.m. appointment to meet a realtor who was reclaiming and developing an area in Detroit's inner city known as the Cass Corridor. A story in the Detroit Free Press, which highlighted this long-ago center for the arts, prompted us to be adventurous on this dreary November Sunday. As we turned off the expressway onto Forest Avenue, my eyes caught sight of the Detroit Curling Club. My God! It was as though I had just discovered an extinct dinosaur. What on earth was a curling club doing here? Who knows how long it had been since there were enough people who inhabited this arsenal of democracy to not only actually curl, but form a club and build a facility. I could never understand why television gave so much coverage to the sport anyway. I'd never met anyone who ever knew anyone who curled. In fact, I have no idea what ethnic group laid claim to this sport. Whoever they are, they didn't live here anymore. And I was beginning to believe that I shouldn't either. We actually had no intention of leaving our guarded fortress and safe Farmington, but here we were, traveling past block after block of the decaying buildings that had somehow escaped the riots of 66 and Detroit's most recent phenomenon of Devil's Night. I started to wonder if we were ever going to get there. We both remained silent as though we were watching a television documentary projected on the windows of our car. Paranoia was definitely starting to set in. It was as if we had a large sign on the side of our car announcing that the suburban folks are coming. The stares from those we passed in the street reinforced our feelings. I felt compelled to make eye contact, maybe because I was looking for a friendly face. In retrospect, I'm sure our appearance there was very unusual. After all, wasn't this Detroit's infamous Cass Corridor? What were we doing here anyway? As our car approached the intersection of 2nd and Willis, I knew we were close, but I didn't know how close. As we scanned the building numbers looking for 4142, one thing became very evident. This neighborhood had seen better times. Mammoth Victorian brownstones stood like monuments to their glorious past. I kept thinking, how could this happen? Then long at last there it was. 4142 2nd Avenue. Parked there at the curb was an upside-down, burned-out checker cab. No way, Jack, I declared. No way would I ever live in this neighborhood. We're just looking, Maggie interrupted. You tell the realtor, Maggie, that it ain't looking good either. I stopped the car directly behind what remained of that checker cab. As I turned the ignition key and killed the engine, I felt the urge to start it again and leave immediately. But we had made the appointment, and we were going to keep it. Those were actually Maggie's words. She also said, "It doesn't hurt to look, does it?" Just then her question was answered in the person of Bill Jeffries. "You must be the Ekmans. It's as if we had a sign on us. We don't belong here." With that, we both jumped out of the car and exchanged further niceties with our newest friend. He ushered us past the burned-out Checker as if it wasn't even there and into a stone row house just a few doors down the street. I later discovered that it was technically a terrace, not a row house. In fact, it was the last true terrace left standing in Detroit. Somehow it had escaped Coleman Young's wrecking ball. Built in the 1890s, it was a massive three-story stone fortress appearing structure with medieval turrets at the top. Our surprise came as we opened the front door, and we were greeted by 14-foot ceilings, white plastered walls, and beautifully refinished hardwood floors. Maggie was oohing and aahing as we went from floor to floor, eventually climbing to the third floor servants' quarters. He explained that this unit was already sold, but he was finishing the remaining other units by spring, and if we signed now, we could get our choice of unit and decorating scheme. Scheme seemed to be the operative word here for the moment. I had to admit, however, the price sounded pretty good, and my Hollywood image of a New York-type row house, even though it was a terrace, right here in Detroit, seemed too good to be true. For a moment, the image of the burned-out cab and all of the corridor's other blemishes were out of sight. I came out from under the ether just in time to announce that we'd think it over. Then our realtor reminded us that he and his family lived just down the street, and this was a really unique and wonderful neighborhood. I suppose that's when we should have left, but by this time, I actually wanted to believe him. I'm sure he sensed this because he went for the close and reminded us that because of the story in the Detroit Free Press, he was sure that these jewels wouldn't last long. After all, isn't that how we found out about them? Yes, we both nodded like trained seals, but came to our senses and announced again, we'd think it over and let him know. If they're gone by then, they're gone. Much to our surprise, he backed off. Wait a minute here. Either this is the greatest salesman I've ever seen, or he really believes it. If it was the former, what was he doing here? Later, I would think that of almost every resident of the neighborhood I met who had any talent or ability to survive and prosper in the outside world. As we drove back to the freeway, our speedy escape route to the suburbs, we came face to face with the reality of the corridor and the city decay at its fullest. Litter, garbage, and ruin everywhere. Not to mention the obvious, the hookers, pimps, and drug dealers who blatantly marketed their goods in the street. Little did I know then that these people would soon become our neighbors and play a major role in our lives. This was just the beginning. Maggie used our trip home to mouth all of the advantages of buying. She reminded me I wasn't getting any younger. Had I not been ruined financially by my divorce? And wouldn't this be a great tax write-off, investment, etc., etc.? My God, she had been bitten by the real estate vampire. I immediately looked for a Century 21 pocket patch. But what I saw was a beautiful young Italian-American woman in her late 20s who had chucked everything to follow me back to Detroit and continue a relationship that she had no way of knowing would lead anywhere. We'd been living together for more than a year, and marriage was something neither of us ever talked about or believed was necessary. Maggie, too, had gone through a nasty divorce, ending a 5-year marriage to her high school sweetheart. We were children of the 60s and 70s and didn't need a piece of paper to officially declare our love. Hadn't we proven that by surviving everything and everybody who told us that this would never work? And now, here we were, discussing a move that could be the greatest challenge of all, not only to our relationship, but to our very lives.